Welcome to this special edition of Voices, featuring a presentation from the 2010 Camden Conference, held in Camden, Maine from February 19th to 21st. I'm Jim Campbell. This year's Camden Conference theme was an especially relevant one: Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Crossroads of Conflict. It brought together scholars, former ambassadors, military educators, and cultural observers to wrestle with the situation in South Asia and the roles of the U.S., of NATO, and of countries in the region in trying to bring stability to that troubled area. One of those who offered his observations on the U.S. military strategy in Afghanistan was Larry Goodson, whose presentation we'll hear today. Dr. Goodson is a professor of Middle East Studies in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He's the author of several books on Afghanistan and has served in Afghanistan in various roles since 2001. After his presentation, he responded to questions from the audience, and we'll hear some of those exchanges as well. Right now, Larry Goodson, introduced by Nicholas Burns, the conference moderator.
Larry's going to talk about U.S. military strategy in Afghanistan. As you know, there's been a major shift over the last several years, particularly last year, the influence of General Petraeus and General McChrystal on a new counterinsurgency strategy is the hallmark of the new Obama contribution to American policy in Afghanistan. We're delighted Larry's here, and I would invite him to the podium. Larry Goodson.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick. I would begin by saying that, like Ahmed Rashid, I possess stereotypes about Maine. And because of those, I am in deep trouble with my wife, who I told she shouldn't, you know, bother coming because it's going to be cold and snowy. And now my friends, the Jenkins, tell me that, you know, it normally is but cold and snowy. But when I got out at Portland and the palm trees were waving and I was in a short sleeve shirt, and I called my wife back in Pennsylvania where there's a couple of feet of snow still on the ground, she was not amused. So anyway, thank you. Thank you for your kind invitation to join you as you consider a region and a country that I have studied and loved for a long time, and to consider an issue that is really at the heart of U.S. foreign policy today. I've been asked to speak on U.S. military strategy in Afghanistan. I am happy to do so, but I'm still in government service, and therefore I must offer you the ritual disclaimer, namely that, and you can see it up there, picture of me in my younger days, when I used to hang out with a lot of the people that were now busily trying to kill. But anyway, you see it up there. I'm going to say the views I express are my own and do not necessarily reflect the positions of the U.S. Army War College, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Now, at the war colleges, we teach our students that strategy is the calculated relationship between ends, ways, and means, and that strategy is to be subordinate to policy, which is a government's broad position on a particular issue. The job then of the military strategist is to apply the military tool of power in an appropriate way to execute the mission provided by the policymaker. The military is, of course, not the only tool of our national security policymakers and strategists, but generally we use the military in pursuit of vital national interests. Among the most important of the other tools for the national security policymakers and strategists are diplomacy, trade, aid, and development, or economics, and information, thus creating the famous acronym DIME, diplomatic, information, military, and economic tools. I mention all of this at the outset because, especially in an age of nation building and counterinsurgency, there has been a blurring of the traditional bureaucratic lines separating who wields certain tools and how those tools should be wielded. Moreover, some tools in the toolkit are more expensive and more robust. For fiscal year 2010, for example, the Department of Defense has a budget of $663.8 billion and just under 1.5 million people on active duty, while the Department of State Agency for International Development get $52.1 billion and have about 13,000 personnel. So that makes about a 10-to-1 difference in funding and a 100-to-1 difference in personnel. That also makes the military not only our most powerful, maybe sometimes our most effective, but certainly our most expensive foreign policy tool. Now, before I turn to the military strategy, I also mentioned policy and that that drives the strategy, or at least we think it should. You've got a couple of great speakers that are going to come and talk about policy, so I'm going to just put up here the current policy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, according to the President of the United States. I'm not going to really talk about it. This is the white paper on U.S. policy toward Afghanistan and Pakistan, March 2009. I would note for you that the core goal of the U.S., he says, is to disrupt, dismantle, defeat al-Qaeda and its safe havens in Pakistan and prevent their return to Pakistan or Afghanistan. He uses the code language, vital to U.S. national security. And after announcing that policy, General Stanley McChrystal was appointed as the new commander, and he set about developing the new strategy in line with this policy. Now, you all know what happened next. General McChrystal's strategy was leaked to Bob Woodward at the Washington Post in September of 2009, which sparked a subsequent public, slow process of policy strategy deliberations at the White House, which culminated in President Obama's second policy statement on Afghanistan in a speech at West Point, New York, at the Military Academy at the beginning of December of last year. In that speech, again, not to really discuss it, except to say that President Obama announced that more troops would be sent to Afghanistan because our national security was at stake due to the resilience of the extremists present along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. So in that speech, he essentially endorsed the leak strategy of General McChrystal, and so I'm going to turn to that strategy now. The McChrystal strategy, if I'll just call it that, is based on the notion that success in Afghanistan is achievable, but to get there, we must redefine the fight. By that, he means that we must turn our focus or our military focus to counterinsurgency, called COIN. The military loves acronyms. And I'll talk a little bit about COIN and what that is here in just a moment. That we also have to understand the criticality of time. That's what it says, criticality of time, by which he means that we have to make short-term progress, but let that set up a long-term commitment, and that we need to change the operational culture. Now, that means a lot of things to the military folks. In shorthand, and I'll say more about this later, it means sort of less bombing, more cultural awareness and connection to the Afghan people. The new strategy focuses on securing the population, and it has the four major areas of emphasis that you see here. First, it calls for improving effectiveness through greater partnering with the Afghan National Security Forces. That means to increase the pace of training and mentoring of the Afghan National Army and the various Afghan police, make those forces much larger, to more than double them from their current size to 400,000 by 2011, and deploy those forces more effectively so that Afghans are eventually taking the lead in securing their own country. Now, this is where the shift to a counterinsurgency strategy comes in. COIN, if I can use the acronym, differs from more conventional military operations in that COIN is based on what they call a clear, hold, build approach, whereby forces push into an area and clear it of insurgents, then those forces or some follow-on forces hold the area so that follow-on workers can come in to build the infrastructure and provide services that will strengthen the population's connection to the government. The second major area of the strategy is to prioritize responsive and accountable governance. And this is based on the sad reality that was revealed in the electoral fiasco of the August 2009 Afghan elections that you've already heard about, which is that the Karzai government has come to be viewed widely within Afghanistan and by the international community as profoundly illegitimate. Despite widespread electoral fraud and cheating, the nature and extent of which would take too long to detail here, Karzai did not win an outright majority on the first ballot and was then humiliated by the United States into accepting a runoff, which was then made moot when his challenger, former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah, threw in the towel. Since then, though, President Karzai has struggled to get his cabinet nominees confirmed by the parliament, and even now 10 of those 25 or so ministries have yet to have their minister approved. This part of the strategy is critical and problematic because insurgencies are fundamentally political and cannot be defeated by a purely military effort. Thus, providing foreign forces on behalf of a government that its own people hold to be profoundly illegitimate can be a recipe for disaster, meaning that since this is the government that we are stuck with, we must try to make it better. This will be very difficult, for the Afghan government is notoriously corrupt and has performed poorly in delivering services to the people, allowing the insurgents to oppose it by presenting themselves as more capable and less corrupt. Thus, President Obama said at West Point, the days of providing a blank check are over. We will support Afghan ministries, governors, and local leaders that combat corruption and deliver for the people. We expect those who are ineffective or corrupt to be held accountable. Now, those are nice words, those are necessary words, but they are hard achievements to realize due to the localism that Dr. Azoy mentioned this morning, the narco-state structure of the Afghan political economy, and a host of other factors that I won't go into now. The third area of the strategy is maybe the most obvious military part of the strategy, and that is to gain the initiative. This refers to the contours and strength of the insurgency as it exists now. That is, we, you know, the general public, often hear talk of the Taliban as if the Taliban is a monolithic movement. But it is far more complex than that. At least three major entities are part of the Afghan Taliban today. Those would be the Quetta Shura Taliban, the Haqqani Network, headed by Jalaluddin Haqqani and his son Siraj, and Hezbi Islami Gulbuddin, headed by the psychopath, as he was called earlier. That's basically correct. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, I was with Gulbuddin's folks in that picture you saw earlier. All of these organizations operate from sanctuary in Pakistan, where they maintain ties with Pakistani Taliban like the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan and the remnants of Al-Qaeda. These organizations also have ties with Pakistan's Inner Services Intelligence Directorate, or ISI, which has historically maintained militants as a tool of its own foreign policy to wield against India, or the Soviet Union when that country occupied Afghanistan. The different elements of the Taliban that operate in Afghanistan have grown quite strong over the past 2 to 3 years, and especially in southwestern Afghanistan, now form a shadow government that rules large swaths of the country from dusk until dawn. Thus, the insurgency has gained the initiative, and in the strategy, General McChrystal says he intends to gain it back. Now, to do this, for example, through the operation that's ongoing right now to take back control of Marja in northern Helmand province, he needs the forces with which to conduct conventional combat operations. He also, you know, needs more forces with which to train more rapidly the Afghan National Security Forces. When President Obama came into office, he decided to approve a long-standing request for more forces, and in March of last year, when he announced the policy, he also announced an additional 21,000 combat forces, which, along with the support forces that came in, saw some 36,000 more troops deployed to Afghanistan by October of last year, which more than doubled what we had had there prior to that time. Then, of course, as was well documented in the newspapers, General McChrystal asked for more, and in the West Point speech, President Obama announced that another 30,000 were going to be sent over the next 6 months, so they have been flowing in already. Currently, although I know Ambassador Burns gave us a number last night, currently it is not clear to me exactly how many U.S. forces are in Afghanistan. That is because there are some 47,000 or so there as part of the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force, while perhaps another 48,000 or so are still there under Operation Enduring Freedom, which is the U.S. Coalition that also exists there. There is an unknown number of additional forces engaged in other tasks, as well as private security contractors that may also be there. Now, the last piece of the strategy calls for a focusing of resources. This part of the strategy centers on connecting the foreign forces more with the population they are there to protect in numerous small but significant ways, such as reducing or eliminating the use of certain tactics associated with a higher likelihood of civilian casualties, putting more troops out among the people, and increasing the cultural and language training of the troops. This is also where the strategy calls for more civilian resources, since so much of what is deemed essential to success is properly the area of civilian components of the government. I would suggest to you, having described the strategy a bit, that there are four major challenges to its possible success. And I'm just going to run through those challenges very quickly. I won't actually talk about all of them in any depth, but I will this one. First, as I've already said, counterinsurgency is just one of several strategic threads that have been interwoven from the beginning of our involvement in Afghanistan. And I might add, these are threads that are hard to weave together effectively. Each strategy pursues different ends with different ways and means and takes differing lengths of time to mature. State building, or nation building, refers to the process of rebuilding the social, economic, and political institutions of a functioning state. It may be required. There's a pretty solid academic literature suggesting that it is the only way to fix failing and failed states. But the United States has no meaningful capacity to conduct state building operations in conflict zones. It's just not what we have been set up to do. Moreover, state building also takes a long time, and many Americans, like former President Bush, are extremely skeptical that such an approach represents an appropriate use of American resources. Counterterrorism. A counterterrorism approach concentrates on capturing or killing high-value targets from a list of wanted terrorists, such as the leaders of Al-Qaeda, as well as striking at their institutional structure, financial network, and safe havens. With an initial small military footprint in Afghanistan and the subsequent pace of operations in Iraq, Afghanistan became an economy of force theater where limited numbers of troops focused primarily on combat and counterterrorism operations. Now, counterterrorism requires the fewest resources, but it also attempts to achieve the least. So if killing a few bad guys doesn't solve the problem, then counterterrorism may well be the wrong strategy to adopt, although it might be a cost-effective way to kick the can down the road for later administrations to deal with. The United States started with counterterrorism. We were, after all, attacked by terrorists. And we have become unwilling to abandon counterterrorism entirely in the face of the growing strength of anti-Western militants on the Pakistani side of the Durand Line. Conventional combat operations. These are most appropriate when one military force is confronting another military force. And the United States is very good at these kinds of operations. Terrain, geography, the nature of the opponent all reduce the advantages that we normally bring to bear in conventional combat operations for the United States in Afghanistan. For combating an insurgency, which is what we have in Afghanistan, or really several insurgencies sort of all intertwined, counterinsurgency is the preferred strategy. And it is, as I said before, built on the notion that the struggle is politically and that securing the civilian population is key to the resolution of conflict. It does tend to be less sustainable over time than counterterrorism, since COIN requires a lot more troops. Thus, if it takes a long time, as it often does, domestic support back home can fade. The biggest problem with counterinsurgency is that, as I said before, if the government on whose behalf the military is conducting the counterinsurgency is generally held to be profoundly illegitimate, then COIN almost certainly cannot win. The cardinal requirement for success to the military, and I put that down at the bottom of this slide, is always the same: one leader, one plan. We are trying to weave together four strategies. Not surprising, since each strategy has serious deficiencies that the other strategic threads sort of address and try to correct. Each strategy or thread of strategy has at least one powerful bureaucratic or political patron in the current or previous administration. Now, a second challenge is that our toolkit is heavily dependent on our gold-plated military, meaning that any strategy that requires another tool will likely be under-resourced. I don't want to belabor this, but I would say that despite all the calls for a civilian surge, the United States really only has the military to accomplish the bulk of its tasks in Afghanistan. Thus, additional deployments of large numbers of U.S. personnel inevitably means mostly from the military, which suggests, to me anyway, that the only strategy likely to succeed will be one that the military is good at conducting. So if what you really need to do is state building, you might not be so successful in Afghanistan. Third, Afghanistan was a central playing field for what was known in the 19th century as the Great Game between the British and Russian empires. Today, it is the centerpiece of a 21st century geopolitical great game between Russia, China, India, Iran, Pakistan, and, since the fall of 2001, the United States. All of these actors are engaged in pursuing their own national interest in Afghanistan, often through the time-honored tools of war by proxy and diplomacy by intrigue, making it very difficult for us to leave, especially since our reputation for staying power is pretty poor in this part of the world to begin with. Now, I don't have much time, and I can't really do justice to the complexity of the geopolitical environment in a few short sentences, so I'll just give you a quick taste of the problem. Pakistan and India, of course, we heard about this morning, have a long-standing rivalry that dates back to the partition of the subcontinent and their beginnings in 1947. China and India, both aware that through sheer size were fated to compete for dominance of Asia, became continental rivals by the early 1960s. The split between China and the Soviet Union that developed at the same time led the Soviet Union, now Russia, to become a close friend of India's, while China and Pakistan developed a strategic partnership of their own. The Soviet Union, of course, collapsed by the end of 1991, less than 3 years after its own long war in Afghanistan, which allowed the Soviet Central Asian republics to the north of Afghanistan to achieve their independence. Some of those new countries have significant natural resources, and China, India, and a resurgent Russia all want access to those resources. Afghanistan is in the middle of this competition, once again a crossroads, as it has been so often before in its history. The great game, however, the modern great game, not only applies in Afghanistan. China's string of pearls maritime strategy has been augmented by its development of Pakistani infrastructure and Afghanistan's copper mine. And of course, I'm talking specifically in Pakistan about the port of Gwadar, while India has been pursuing its own Indian Ocean strategy through port building in Iran and road building in Afghanistan. And I'm going to take a second to emphasize this. India refurbished the Iranian port of Chabahar right here, so they have, for all the military folks in the audience, you know, outflanked the Chinese at this point anyway. And then they built the road up to Zaranj, and over to Dalaram. And so they've now got a way into Afghanistan that goes around Pakistan and a port that goes beyond the Chinese-funded port of Gwadar. Russia's in this too. Russia's efforts to resurge in Central Asia allow for, among other things, a so-called northern distribution network for supplies to get into Afghanistan. Now, let me just say a quick word about this. Afghanistan is at the bottom of a barrel from a logistical point of view. Currently, some 80% of U.S. and NATO supplies cross Pakistani territory. This is okay, of course, because Pakistan is a major non-NATO ally of the United States, but it's not okay because Pakistan also has a serious Islamist militancy problem that has not been able to control. In fact, I would argue at great length, if it was the subject of my speech and I wasn't coming to the end of my time, that Pakistan is a far more significant challenge for U.S. foreign policy than is Afghanistan, and that Pakistan's internal contradictions provide enormous complications for our Afghanistan strategy. In the interest of time, I'll skip over that. But I will leave you with, on this subject, the big geopolitical question. I realize we have Nick Burns here, so he can't answer this question, but I'll leave it for the rest of you. If the 21st century great game of Asia is shaping up to be a struggle between China, Pakistan, the Gulf Arabs, sort of on one side, and India, Iran, Russia, sort of on the other, then which side is the United States on? We're in the region, so it's not like we can say, oh, we don't take side. No, we're in the region. Anyway, the geopolitics may say stay for the American public, but of course, as we heard earlier, the clock is ticking, and public support for the Afghan campaign is even shakier in many of our partner countries of NATO. Announcing a timetable for planned withdrawal of combat forces responds to that clock, but as we heard this morning, there are multiple audiences that receive the signal, not all of whom are looking at the clock. In his West Point speech, President Obama said, "There are those who oppose identifying a time frame for our transition to Afghan responsibility. Indeed, some call for a more dramatic and open-ended escalation of our war effort, one that would commit us to a nation-building project of up to a decade. I reject this course because it sets goals that are beyond what can be achieved at a reasonable cost and what we need to achieve to secure our interests." Now, as I suggested in an earlier slide, politics drive everything, or so it seems to me. And everyone understands that the folks in office at the moment want to see some measure of success prior to the next round of elections. But how do we achieve that rapid success in those areas of strategy that take a longer time period to ripen? And what about the enemy, the guys without the clocks? If we tell them that we plan to draw down forces in Afghanistan, conditions permitting, in the summer of 2011, what strategy do they then pursue? Well, in truth, and to sort of conclude, any strategy for Afghanistan will be extremely difficult to implement successfully unless success is defined very narrowly and we hasten for the exit as soon as we can reasonably claim to have succeeded. Throughout history, Afghanistan has seen many invaders as people for thousands of years crossed this famous land bridge of Central Asia. Since Alexander the Great's invasion in 330 BC, not one great power that has since entered Afghanistan succeeded in its strategy there, with the exception of Genghis Khan in the 1220s, who basically killed everybody, which I don't personally see as a good strategy, at least anymore. Afghanistan has since earned the nickname Graveyard of Empires because great powers get drawn in there, usually on the road to somewhere else or in order to prevent another country from controlling the area, and then the invading great power fails, often losing its status in the aftermath. The most recent great power to fail in Afghanistan, I have it up there on the slide, was the former Soviet Union. By the eighth year of its war there, the Soviets found themselves faced with all of those problems, all of which exist now in the eighth year of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. Of course, there are key differences, too, as President Obama noted in his West Point speech, in regards to comparing Afghanistan to Vietnam. And I don't wish to give you a simple comparative analogy, but I also don't wish to ignore the lessons of history. Perhaps Afghanistan is a graveyard of empires, or perhaps it is a failed state whose rescue could transform the international system. Either way, the United States faces a conundrum there, which put simply is this: we cannot afford to stay, and we cannot afford to go. I always try to reference The Clash whenever I can in these speeches. For the younger folks in the audience, you might be remember the Sandinista album. Thus, our strategy is aimed at reaching, it seems to me, a measurable amount of success in a short period of time, and then get most of our combat forces out. This is the old declare victory and get out before anyone can prove otherwise approach. If our opponents cooperate, and after all, they want us out and can spin our leaving into their victory as easily as we can call it their defeat, this strategy might work. There is high risk, however, as the historical record for great powers in Afghanistan and in long counterinsurgencies in general is very poor. And although I've run into overtime, I'll give you this last thought because it's very important to me. Three very good Afghan specialists, you should have invited these three people to this conference, except they're in Afghanistan, who are well known to the other people on the program, have all argued to me within the past 3 months that the war in Afghanistan is lost and that the United States should disengage as soon as possible. I disagree that the war is lost. I believe we cannot afford to lose it. But I cannot see how we can be successful as the bully boys for a deeply corrupt and ineffective Afghan government while our own population becomes increasingly uncertain about whether our ends, ways, and means match up appropriately in Afghanistan. I may have left you with more questions than I provided answers, but I thank you for the invitation and your attention.
We're listening to a presentation by Professor Larry Goodson at the 2010 Camden Conference, here on Community Radio, WERU-FM in Blue Hill, and on the web at www.weru.org. We now return to the Camden Conference and to the question and answer session that followed Dr. Goodson's presentation.
Thank you very much for a very fine exposition of a complex problem. I have two questions immediately, okay. Then we'll turn to the audience. The first is this: if Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires, if we're the latest empire to try to pacify it, it seems that President Obama, as did President Bush, has a lot riding on counterinsurgency, specifically General McChrystal's plan. Can it work to at least stem the tide of the Taliban advance and give the civil authorities in Afghanistan some time to recover and stabilize the country? What's your prediction about this over the next 2 years?
The answer to your question is yes. It can do what you said. However, the danger is what we've already heard. If the civil authorities can't then pick up the ball and run with it, or if the Afghan security forces also can't do that, then at some point the American taxpayer and his and her representatives, all of whom are acutely aware of economic conditions in this country and so forth, they're probably going to say, gee whiz, maybe we shouldn't continue doing this, especially if they continue hearing about the corruption and the problems of the government. For me, the election last year was a huge problem because...
Corrupt, failed election.
Exactly. Yeah. Because I was actually one of the monitors of the 2002 Emergency Loi Jirga and the technical advisor to that election. I was the guy who carried the keys to the ballot boxes in my pocket. I don't know if you knew that. And I was like not letting that election be failed as best I could anyway. But this election was a big problem because it revealed, you know, we all knew this, but it revealed it to the world. And I don't know how we go forward. I mean, the Constitution needs amending, things need changing. As Witt said earlier, you need a much more localized system that fits the social contours of the country, but I don't know how we're going to get there.
Well, that leads to my next question. Most civil wars do not end the way ours did at Appomattox. They end in negotiations. They end because the sides compromise. They work out, they reconcile, they work out a deal. I was a little bit surprised to hear, and maybe I misunderstood it, that you think that the most of the weight of U.S. policy rests on the shoulder of the military. I kind of think that we're going to see a transition where the diplomats, the American diplomats, the American aid workers are going to have a lot more responsibility, because I see this ending in some kind of compromise negotiation, not in a military victory. But how do you react to that?
No, I hope, I didn't mean, of course, that...
I got you.
I'm not trying to speak for DOD. What I was trying to do was to suggest that the money suggests that we have constructed a toolkit where the big M is mostly what we have. I certainly agree that Richard Holbrooke and all the other diplomats have a lot of heavy lifting to do in the days ahead. My own suggestion, I was part of the team that worked on this last year at this time was, I shouldn't say that, but was that we put the super envoy, whoever that was going to be, in charge of everything. Remember, one leader, one plan, and not a general or an admiral. That was met with snorts of derision by many people. But that was because I share your general view that the long-term solution is primarily one that's going to have to be negotiated and not one that's going to come from the military. But the military is where we have all the resources, or, you know, many of the resources. That was the point I was trying to make.
And fair enough, and a very good point. Now I understand it more fully. It is true that there are more lawyers in the Pentagon than American diplomats, and there are more members of the armed forces, bands of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines than American diplomats.
That's true.
There are 6,500, roughly, American active American diplomats in the world. And so I think Larry's given us a good sense of how unbalanced our policy has been. I very much have supported what our military is doing,
sure,
but our civilian component has just been too weak to really finish this the way it needs to be finished.
Well, if you're going to do coin or state building,
right,
you're going to need those other aspects of the government. So.
Right.
Yeah, Nick is right. You can put all of the Nicks in the State Department on the deck of an aircraft carrier.
Right. Right. So. Okay.
Anyway.
On that happy note. And Secretary Hillary Clinton has asked the Congress for a major expansion of the United States Foreign Service and for a restructuring and rebuilding of USAID. And if we're going to be successful here and other places, we have to do that as a society, I think. Yes?
Patrick Fisher, University of Maine. With this administration trying to shift the war away from the battlefield, how much influence does the U.S. weapon industry have on the war? And what is their role? And to what extent do they affect military decisions on how to fight this war?
That's a wonderful question. I have no idea what the answer to that question is. I mean, obviously, the defense industry shapes, in some respects, the way the services are constructed to fight wars, and that proceeds from assessments and decisions that are made at the Pentagon, looking ahead to the threats in the out years, the next 4, 5, 10 years, and then the services. Request certain kinds of weapon systems. As probably everyone in this audience knows, Secretary Gates last year basically killed a number of weapons systems to save money and began shifting things around. So it's hard to say, because really the war effort, as I've described it, the strategy as I've described it, is a boots on the ground kind of strategy. So it's labor intensive. It's not, you know, weapon system intensive. Certain, you know, small things like predators and so forth might get a boost.
Another question in the balcony. Yes.
Yes, I'm intrigued by this notion of the civilian surge, which is kind of a neat new concept. My My view of history, particularly 19th century history, is pretty shaky. But it seems like to me the British in their colonial era were pretty good at getting in with some troops and then throwing the civilian bureaucracy into places to actually hold them, if you will. I wonder if you could assess how much of this kind of force, and would it be, in a sense, carved out of the military? I'm not sure it's a diplomatic force. It's more of a civilian infrastructure force that could be used for this, because I suspect we're going to go through this in a lot of places, certainly in Africa. It's desperately needed, it seems like to me as well.
Well, very quickly, in Afghanistan and in Iraq, we've seen the advent of provincial reconstruction teams, or PRTs, and at the State Department, the creation of the Office of the Coordinator of Stabilization and Reconstruction, both of which are entities that are really designed to mix the civilians and the military in these kinds of settings. The reference you made to the 19th century, the British largely did that with their political service of their army. So they were sort of political officers, not maybe dissimilar to our foreign area officers today, or some of the folks that are serving on PRTs in provinces of Afghanistan.
And I just compliment what Larry said in answer to the very good question, that it is a diplomatic State Department, USAID surge that's required. We learned a big lesson in our four interventions in the 90s and in this decade, Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Iraq. The State Department and USAID were too weak and not structured properly to take responsibility when the fighting stopped. And so that rested on the shoulders of our lieutenants, our captains, and our majors. And we asked them to do things for which they were not trained. They did a fabulous job in many instances.
Yeah, that's true.
So we've tried to rebuild the capacity of state that diplomats can be expeditionary, not just in the gilded halls of Europe, but embedded with troops, as they are currently in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Secretary Clinton is very wisely continuing this effort that Secretary Rice started. So it is a diplomatic surge in that name. I think we have a question from one of our remote sites. From Louis Sell, who's a retired Foreign Service officer, good friend in Rockland. Does the United States have enough troops in Afghanistan? I think I gave the number 108, whether we're at 108 or, is that sufficient to accomplish effective counterinsurgency?
No, it isn't, especially if you don't have the civilian surge, which, by the way, was in the white paper in March of 2009. So. But the intent is to push the number up a bit higher, but then, as we've heard earlier, to then quickly withdraw them. So I'm not quite sure what the right number is. There are all sorts of formulas that tell you to do this properly. You need hundreds of thousands and so forth. I don't think that that's sustainable. So we probably don't have enough troops if it's state building and counterinsurgency. If it's counterterrorism, yeah, we've got more than enough to do that.
And Larry and I were talking before we started. One way to rephrase this question is, do we have enough European troops as well?
Right.
Because NATO's there. And NATO went in 2003. And one of the great tragedies of this arrangement that we have, the United States has stood up, and our sons and daughters are there. But the Europeans, with some notable exceptions, are refusing, many of them, the Germans, the Spaniards, the Italians, to serve in the South and East, where the majority of the fighting is. And they're, in effect, sitting out the war in the North and West. It has divided the NATO alliance. We have a number of good allies in the South and East, but those three large continental powers are not there, unfortunately.
And the ones who have gone, Canada, Great Britain,
Netherlands,
the Dutch, and so forth,
Danes.
They're really struggling with their home public opinion. The Canadians are constantly on the verge of, you know, maybe we should be pulling out of Afghanistan. And now, of course, we've signaled a timetable, so that provides top cover for any Europeans and Canadians who would want to go.
We can fit in very quickly. A quick question here and a quick answer.
Yes.
Yes.
Jory Squibb here. I'd like to spin out the scenario of letting the Taliban win, and that they are successful in controlling 80% of the territory, and basically, one might suspect that though they're very bratty as a splinter group, once allowed to govern, we might see a different sort of Taliban emerge. And I'm also just aware of the Vietnam past, where we were engaged in something that we felt we could not lose. We absolutely could not lose this war. And yet, when we did lose it, there was a decade or so of chaos there, certainly. But basically, the Vietnamese people found their feet. They found a way of being a part of the world community. And so I'm just like to hear you spin out the scenario of we withdraw and the Taliban takes over.
Yeah, I'll be very quick. I actually posed that scenario to a senior general not long ago. He was not amused. I suggested that maybe the Taliban should surrender in the south and let them take over and do counterinsurgency against us. And I know a lot of special forces soldiers that would really enjoy being insurgents rather than counterinsurgents. But you know, realistically, I like Ahmed, knew quite a few of the senior Taliban back in the day, and they were horrible at governance. It would be bad for them. They would struggle because they aren't popular. They're just, you know, better in local places than what the local folks see the government as. In terms of losing, well, yeah, that was the big geopolitical question. Which cup of poison do you prefer? And I'd have to say that declaring victory and getting out, which is, I think, where we ultimately end up, is probably less poisonous both for the Afghans and for us than staying indefinitely and bleeding. But that's just my view.
Thank you. Larry, thank you very much.
Professor Goodson's talk was one of three that took place at the conference on Saturday afternoon. To conclude the afternoon sessions, all three presenters, Larry Goodson, who we just heard, Paul Pillar, former National Intelligence Officer for South Asia and the Middle East, and Ronald Newman, former U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan, came together as a single panel for questions. Here is the question that started that session, posed by Nicholas Burns, the conference moderator.
So the first question goes to Ron. I sense, Ron, from what you said, that you're somewhat unsure of President Obama's commitment to his stated policy. But if I've mischaracterized your views, you let me know. And so here's the question. Are we right in trying to divine what he's up to, that perhaps President Obama believes we need to regain the initiative, reassert some control over the general military situation, to buy time for the Afghans, but also then to perhaps transition to the political solution that Ahmed and Paul and others have talked about? Is that what President Obama is up to, and is that the correct policy for our country?
Only the president, well, the second is, I think, yes, but the first, I would say, is only the president knows for sure. I don't know any way of divining whether he is, you know, what is motivating what he talks about and doesn't. You can hypothesize, and it is perfectly would be perfectly logical to hypothesize that in a very organized administration, the policy which is being pursued by deployment and by everything we are actually doing in Afghanistan and everything being said by every senior member of our government, with no particular leaks to suggest that they're spinning, is in fact the policy. And that the president and the White House being somewhat nervous that they could find themselves as the rerun of the Johnson administration with their domestic agenda defeated by an unpopular war, simply don't want to talk about it. They want to leave this to the cabinet. And that therefore the actions will over time define the policy, in which case that's fine. It means that you will pay a price that the credibility you want, we want, that people in the region accept the real policy as real, will be much harder to establish. So we are creating a certain kind of tension between our goal and our goals domestically. I can understand the reason for it. I personally think the president, if that is his strategy, is making a mistake, not necessarily a fatal one, although it will be fatal to some people who will die while we are creating greater will, but nevertheless, not necessarily fatal to the policy, because you will have you know, a lot of troops, do a lot of things. But I do not know any way that you can go behind that sort of logic and say, are you really sure that he really has his guts in the policy decision he's made? And will he stand up to it? And will he stand up to the pressures on himself and on his party to lead through the next 2-3 years? Because there's nothing you can look at in either his political past or his statements that answer that. And I don't say that to say he won't. I just say there's nothing you could look at analytically to answer the question.
Paul, if I could just ask to continue maybe Ron's thought. I mean, a lot of people talked about the Hamlet-like performance of the president. I don't mean to be disrespectful in saying that or too critical, but he had a policy announced in March. He then announced a reassessment. It went on for quite a long time. And he announced, as Larry pointed out, a slightly revised version of that policy December 1. What's your sense of the president's commitment, and where do you think he's heading?
I give the president a lot of credit for the procedures he's followed. I think it is very unfair, the accusations of so-called dithering. Right. He had to make a fairly rapid set of decisions in his first couple of months of office, and hence the policy version 1.0 after Bruce Rydell's review. He had to do that because he was new. And then other things happened, especially the election, which we all agree was an unfortunate event the way it was occurred, and that necessitated the more thorough review. From every indication, it was indeed thorough. This does not eliminate, however thorough the deliberations in the sit room may be, the political realities that he's dealing with. So I give him high marks on process. My own take on the particular question that you asked to Ron is, President Obama is extremely intelligent, and I think one indication of that is he is not trying to make predictions, either publicly or in his own mind, I would guess, about exactly what the political pressures will be on him, in 2011 or 2012, or exactly what the battlefield situation will be. I think he rightly expects a large degree of uncertainty. He will have other bridges he will have to cross at the time, and he is not trying to decide in advance all of those bridges are going to be.
Nick, could I just add, I do not fault the president for the second review for exactly the reasons Paul has laid out. And I think, however costly to us abroad, and it is costly because people perceived it as weakness, it was necessary within the American political structure. What I'm saying simply is what the president chooses to talk about now, post-policy, and what he chooses not to talk about has a cost in raising questions. And that question that will be answered over time by his other actions. But I'm not faulting the review itself.
Yeah. I think a lot of people would say that after the rush to war in 2003, it was refreshing to see a president take such care with a war and peace decision. I agree with both of you. Ahmed, let me just extend this, and we will get to the audience. If Ron and Paul are right, that we might be looking at the slow transformation of a policy towards some kind of political solution, will there be enough strength in the Pakistani government, civilian government, military government, to hold on, keep Pakistan relatively stable, so that they're not facing a crisis on both sides of the border that can't be resolved?
Just before I answer that, can I just say one thing, that last night the Dutch government fell on the issue of troops in Afghanistan. The coalition partners that were part of the Dutch government want the troops pulled out immediately. They brought the government down. There's going to be an election, and it's quite likely that those parties which want troops out are going to win the election. So, and Holland has major troops in Oruzgan province, which is neighboring Helmand. It's in the south of the country. These are part of the fighting troops, not troops that don't fight. And it's obviously going to be, a major blow. I just thought I'd mention that. I think the whole both these arguments. I'm a bit worried by Paul's argument, because I don't think Paul has argued illogically about anything. But his argument, taken in a snapshot, is likely to be picked up by those who would say, let's cut and run right now. And that's what I fear most of all. I think, you know, there has to be, I mean, what I was trying to argue last night, there has to be a measured withdrawal, which is based on political negotiations, and most of all, stabilizing the region. Stabilizing Afghanistan, to what extent it can be stabilized, and stabilizing the region. The key to that, obviously, is going to be Pakistan. Pakistan has still not, the military at least, has still not given up its ambitions to dominate a future post-America Afghanistan. And how the US is going to be able to water that down, I think this administration has achieved an awful lot already with the Pakistani military. I mean, we have the Pakistani military in the last 1 year going up against in the tribal areas against the Pakistani Taliban, cooperating on intelligence with the drones, etc. Now, will there be a sufficient time and enough coherent policy whereby you will be able to have 18 months, 24 months, 30 months before the next American election to convince the Pakistani military that it has to be part of helping stabilize Afghanistan? Because if it moves unilaterally, it is going to earn the enmity of the Afghans and the entire region. And that is going to plunge the region into a new conflict over which really, I mean, there's no guarantees of where that would end.
So Larry, this is a choice of great strategic importance, what the president's done. How do you, your last word on this particular question, how do you assess the president's ultimate goal here?
I would say that, first of all, I completely agree with the deliberative process. We actually had, and this may not be well known to the public, although it was reported somewhat, we had, I think, 4 or 5 assessments done by different parts of the government as the Bush administration was going out and as the Obama administration was coming in. I was part of the assessment, the big one that General Petraeus did. Ambassador Newman also served on that in a capacity as well. But there was one by the National Security Council. There was one by the Joint Staff at the Pentagon, the one that followed by Rydell and Holbrook and Flournoy. And then we also had all these new appointments, as is the case with a new administration. They get to put their people in. And eventually that led to the replacement of General McKiernan by General McChrystal. And naturally, he then wanted to assess and lay out the strategy that he thought was appropriate. So all of that seemed correct to me. I look at Afghanistan as a situation now, this many years down the road, where our leadership is doing precisely the right thing to achieve the objectives that have been stated. It may prove to be insufficient, or we may prove to be as unfortunate as those previous great powers. I mean, this is where Ambassador Newman and I are sort of quibbling over how much time and, you know, whether we can execute it properly and all of that, but it's probably about as good as you can do. It may prove to be not enough, especially given the government problems we have in Afghanistan.
Thank you. That's a very good start to a very important set of questions.
We just heard a part of the Q&A session that concluded the Saturday afternoon session at the 2010 Camden Conference. That short excerpt was preceded by a presentation and Q&A session by Dr. Larry Goodson, Professor of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. If you'd like more information on the Camden Conference, please go to www.camdenconference.org. If you'd like to hear this program again, or other programs in this series, go to www.weru.org, click on Online Audio Features and Past Public Affairs Programs, and then on Camden Conference. Thanks for listening to this special edition of Voices, and please tune in again Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. and Tuesday afternoons at 4 p.m. for future editions of Voices.